Thank you very much. This is good. Thank you very much. It's a schus and a pleasure to be here to give a shiur in this wonderful program. I want to thank TAC and teach you for organizing the shiur. Mamash, it's a schus to be able to give a shiur to so many wonderful benos Torah. Okay. What I want to do tonight is talk about Rav Salvechik Tzal, the Rav Zatzal, and learn lessons and inspiration from his life and from his teachings. The Rav was a giant, he was a super giant. I was never in the Kashir, because it was at the Grand Talmud of Rav Salvechik. Most of my Rebbeim are his Talmidim. And over the years, you hear stories and ideas, you know, you want to share. In the last couple of years, many books have been coming out that talk about stories from the Rav. And what I did basically was I went to four books and took out some of the different highlights from the books. There's a book called Memories of a Giant, which has many hespedim given about Rav Salvechik after he died. There's a book called Mentor of the Generations. It's a list of, again, articles written by Talmidim of the Rav spanning around 40 years in the Rav Shir. Then there's biography about the Rav, written by Rabbi Rakefet, two volumes called The Rav. So everything here in the sheets in front of you are taken from those books. We're going to read them and discuss them and try to bring out ideas for life that we can apply in our own lives based on things we see in the books, and sometimes maybe going a little bit further as well. I just noticed in the source sheet, okay, let's begin. And okay, number one. Topic number one is Amelus V'Tova. Amelus V'Tova. Rav Salvechik, his core, his essence, tremendous Amelus V'Tova, working hard at the learning. And, you know, the Rav was involved in many things, but at his core, it was a tremendous Amelus V'Tova. The Rav spent most of his life looking at an open Gemara. The Rav spent most of his life looking at and working on open Gemara. This I heard Rabbi Tversky says this. If you're interested, by the way, Rabbi Tversky, Shlita, has several shirim on the internet talking about the Rav. They're very good, very good. Also, he has two articles that I'd highly recommend. One is, he wrote an article in Tradition in 1993, and I still think it's the best article that came out about the Rav. And a lot of things that we're saying, you can find ideas like that coming out in the article. Also, he wrote a very good article in Jewish Action in the late 90s on the Rav's approach to women's minyanim, which is, I highly recommend. If you're going to read two things about the Rav, read those two articles. The Rav was an Amel V'Tova. In the biography about the Rav, there are two volumes, and there are pictures. Both pictures are important. One picture is the Rav like this, sitting deep in thought. And for the Talmidim in the Rav Shir, this was a classic picture. Let's read source number one on the first page. The Rav's intellectual honesty was impressive and awe-inspiring. I'm just reading parts of it, the middle of the paragraph. Then suddenly, he fell silent, put his head in his hands, and said nothing for 20 minutes. And the boy asked Akasha, he started thinking for 20 minutes. You have to understand, in the Shir, you're the Gadol Hador, and you sit there thinking about one topic for 20 minutes. The impact it had in the Talmidim, it's indescribable. Just to think about, most of us have a hard time thinking about one topic for 15 seconds. And it's one topic, 20 minutes. After the 20 minutes, the Rav stood up, closed the Gemara, and announced to his stunned students that the Shir was over. That the Talmud had asked Akasha, he couldn't answer, and the next day he would... He would change. This is a picture of Talmidim had of the Rav, sitting there deep in thought, watching someone being totally Amel V'Tova. One of the best hespedim given about the Rav was given by Rav Yaakov Weinberg Zatzal at the time, the Rosh Shiva of Nei Yisrael. It's printed in the book Memories of a Giant. And again, if you're going to read one hesped, I would read that one. Tremendous hesped. So I quoted here in sources 2 through 4, he talks about the Rav as follows. First, he talks about, in source number 2, the Rav's koach in hasbara, in explaining things. That it's one thing to learn at a high level, to learn a Gemara deeply. It's another thing to have the ability to explain difficult topics in a clear-cut, precise way. And that was part of the Rav's godliness, that he was able to do that. That's the first point he makes. But that's not the main point in his hesped. The main point in this Hesped is about this Nakuda of Amelus Batov. This is Rabbi Yaakov Weinberg that's all speaking. He was again the Rosh Yeshiva of Neisrael. Source number 3. If we are to understand what he really contributed, we have to go back to that Amelus Batov. The hallmark of a true Talmud Chacham is Amelus Batov. Where did his Amelus show itself? And what did it express itself? Rabbos, I will tell you that which not many know, because not many could have seen and appreciated. This man, this Gadol, this Mechadesh Kedushin, this man from whom there flowed a torrent, of new insights, new concepts, new understandings, a constant flow, etc., would sit up nights and be unable to sleep or rest or sit when there was a hard Rashi, a Shver Rashi that he couldn't reconcile, a Rashba that seemed not to make sense. He couldn't live with it. He couldn't exist until somehow or other he had broken through and resolved the Shverkeit, the Kasha. He couldn't eat. He would not sleep. He would go on hour after hour after hour. This man would work because there was a kasha to be resolved. There is truth there. Amelus B'Torah reflects your understanding, your appreciation of the emes in Torah. Torah is emes, and if that's emes, I'm going to work as hard as I can to get to the emes. This was the core, the essence of the Rav, the Amelus B'Torah. The next paragraph. There was Amelus B'Torah breaking the back and breaking a something to understand, to elucidate, to clarify, to come to know the meaning of a new condition Torah. Never mind the Rambam, a Rashi, a Rashba, a Shver Rashi, a Rashba unanswered, he would work to do it. This was go to source number 4. But this Amelus that he stood for, this totality of commitment, this absolute acceptance of Torah as being truly supreme, it's a loss that will not be able to be replaced. You have to understand what it means, again, that this was the Rav's, the complete, totally was taken over to figure out a kasha, to figure something out, that Amelus B'Torah. There are stories here, unbelievable stories here, like quoted in sources 5 and 5a. This is from the book from the Rav's, the mentor of generations, Rav's Talmidim. This is from one of the Rav's Shamashim. He says here as follows. Source number 5. Once the Rav worked with such riveting focus on one of his famed Yahrzeit rushes, sitting hunched over a written desk for long hours, that he severely bruised his ribcage from the pressure of the position. He had been oblivious to the pain throughout. Again, totally lost in the sugya. There are gemaras about this, that some Tanoim were so focused on their learning that their thumbs would bleed, their thumbs were under their legs, and they were pushing their thumbs down. And this is a complete involvement in learning. Next, I remember a difficult 3 or 4 hour shearing, source 5a. The Rav would often come back to his apartment, go straight to the table, open his gemara, continue working on the problems of the sugya for several hours more. There was no thought of stopping to eat lunch. My attempts to provide him with lunch were futile, and I would eventually be forced to leave the food on the table. The next story, I was shaking. One evening during my college years, I accompanied my father, who had some documents to deliver to the Rav. As pre-arranged at 10 p.m., we rang the bell. The Rebbetzin Soloveitchik answered the door. My father explained that the Rav had requested the documents we had brought. Mrs. Soloveitchik seemed very subdued and serious. Her eyes were red. She expressed her regrets and plaintively explained, "He has and left his desk all day, not even to eat or drink. He came home from the minyan this morning and said he was troubled by a difficult Rashi. He went into his study 14 hours ago and still hasn't come out." The envelope was left in her keeping, and we walked back to the car in utter silence, with a heightened conception of Amelus B'Torah. To work on the same topic straight for 14 hours, this was the Rav. When the Rav was Nifter, so at the Shloshim, so there was different Hesvedim in YU. One of them was given by his son, Rabbi Dr. Chaim Soloveitchik. And he's known to be a very precise person, a very precise speaker. And he said that when his father prepared shiur in his study from after breakfast until Mincha, he said this, and you have to know, he's a very precise speaker. He said, "When my father was preparing shir, a bomb could have dropped right next to him. He wouldn't have heard the bomb." That's what Dr. Chaim Soloveitchik said. And this complete absorption in the learning, this was the core, the essence of the Rav. One more story along these lines. For those in the Rav shir, this is a famous story. Source number 6. One Tuesday, the Rav came to shir and announced, "With this week, we're going to finish the third chapter of Erevin." Okay, so the Rav gave shiur at that time for 3 days a week. So now it's Thursday, the last day of shiur of the week. On Thursday at 9 a.m., he began a shiur in front of more than 60 students. He was still lecturing at 4 p.m. Now to approximately 20 students. 7 hours shiur. Suddenly he got up and said, "Boys, why are you so fidgety?" We said, "Rebbe, you've been teaching 7 hours straight. Shiur was supposed to be 10, 4 hours ago." So he said, "We're going to finish the parak." He didn't say we nether. We have to finish. And so in the end, it was matur nether right there. He based in matur nether, and they didn't finish the parak, and shiur ended after around seven and a half hours. This was now that's a little extra long. The rav would give shiur 3 hours, 4 hours, four and a half long shiur. This is the rav, the amelus b'torah, the complete absorption in his learning. There's a famous story that goes around when I was in yeshiva years ago. This story went around. That for a while the Rav would drive himself around, and he stopped driving himself around, and others would drive him. Why? Because the story goes, he was driving, and he was involved in a small accident. And his wife was sitting with him and said, "What happened? Why did you drive into the tree?" And he said, "Oh, I'm sorry. I was thinking about a sugya. I thought you were driving." And, he got lost in the learning. So after that, he stopped driving. That's the story that goes around. Exactly, I don't know if it's exactly accurate, but it could have been accurate. This is the Rav. And you have to understand that this is the core of the Rav, and again, as Rabbi Twersky said, the Rav spent most of his life working on over and open Gemara, difficult Gemaras. This is one major legacy from the Rav, the concept of Amelus v'Torah, Amelus in working on one's Avodas Hashem. You can apply this in learning, you can apply this in growth and Ruchnius in general. You're working on something, you don't give up. A boy is stuck on a difficult Tosfos, you don't give up, you work hard, you struggle with it until you try to crack the nut and get through. You can apply this in Avodah Hashem more broadly. You're working in Avodah Hashem in general. Something's difficult. So keep on going. Work hard. Have that amelus. And that's one major lesson we all can take from the Rav. Okay. That's topic number one. Number two is the topic of surrender. The idea of surrendering to the halacha. This is on page 2. Which it's going to be sources 8 through 10, roughly, so you have to find where page 2 is in your list. The Rav spoke about this a lot. The concept that we have to surrender to the will of Hashem, to surrender, it might be upside down, to surrender to the halacha. Now, this means as follows. We're rational people, we think rationally, and the Rav was very super, very, very intelligent. And sometimes things happen that are difficult to understand. Halacha says X, and it's hard for me to understand the halacha. Does this make sense? Does it seem fair? It's very hard. It seems to us, it doesn't seem to be so fair. So what do you do? So this is Yadus. Yadus is about as much as a person works and we develop the rational part of our Avodas Hashem and we think and we try to understand things, but bottom line, push comes to shove, we surrender to the will of Hashem. And the Rav spoke about this many, many times. One classic source, in source number 8, he tells a story. There was a girl, a non-Jew, and she became a Giora Tzedek. She converted. And after converting, she met a boy who was not religious, and she brought him closer to Orthodox Torah Judaism. And they were going to get married. And he was working out his name, you know what his name, his father's name, for the Ksuva. And he goes to the cemetery to see what his father, how to spell his father's name. And at the cemetery, he noticed that on his father's tombstone, you have this funny little, what's the word? A symbol on the tombstone, like this. What is this funny symbol? Symbol of Kohanim. That when Kohanim give the bracha, that's the way they shape their hands. So they brought the shah, a Kohen can't marry a Gioris, can't marry a convert. This girl is a tzedekah, she's a Gioris tzedek. She brought him back to Torah Judaism. And now they can't get married. It seems so difficult. What can we do? This is the halacha. A Kohen may not marry a convert. We surrender to the will of the Almighty. Now, on the other hand, to say that the halacha is not sensitive to problems and is not responsive to the needs of people is an outright falsehood. The halacha is responsive to the needs of both community and the individual. The halacha, it has flexibility, but you can't break the halacha, and it's usher. There's no way out. A Kohen can't marry a Gioris. I surrender to the will of the Almighty. Now, nowadays, Baruch Hashem, this is very well entrenched, this idea, but in the 40s and 50s, this was the struggle in America, between Orthodoxy and conservatism. Conservatism nowadays has moved so far to the left, it's kemat basically the same as Reformed. But there was a time where no, conservative, they really try to keep it to be in the halacha and have their view of the halacha. And this was exactly the core issue where there's just no way to listen. They'll say, listen, it doesn't make sense. The modern world, you have to update things in Rahman al-Hassan to change things in the Torah. Because, you know, the modern world's different. And we say, no, you surrender to what Hashem says no matter what. And the Rav was one of the leaders in that fight. And these types of statements in public, these types of speeches, helped Orthodoxy carry the day and reassert itself in the last 40 and 50 years. There's a beautiful piece in source number 10 from Rabbi Emanuel Feldman. He's not from YU. He was a Mary Soil graduate. And he was a Rav in Atlanta for many years. And he writes that this idea that the Rav, you have to understand, the Rav's in New York, and this person, he's known to be basically the smartest person around. He knows Kol HaTorah Kula. The Rav knew philosophy. He knew kemat everything. He knew mathematics. If you read the book, Halachic Mind, you have to know physics and mathematics to begin to think about understanding that book. And here you have a person who everyone knows is the smartest person around. And he's up there, and he says, I surrender to Hashem. He writes that the chizuk this gave to rabbis around the country in their struggle to maintain orthodoxy against conservatism can't be overestimated. That the, knowing the Rav was there, just the way he spoke in his existence, that the idea that this person talks about halacha in the modern terms and he surrenders to the will, as smart as he is, the most rational, smartest person, and still gave tremendous chizuk. He writes here, it contributed measurably to the morale of an Orthodox community which in mid-century was being buffeted on all sides and was beset with self-doubt and dispiriting retreats on many fronts. In particular, it had a major impact on the American-trained Orthodox rabbinate. Not all of them studied under a yeshiva, Rabbi Yitzhak Ochanan, of Yeshiva University, but they all benefited directly from the spiritual support and inspiration which his teachings provided at a critical juncture in American Jewish history. The undersigned, not a student in Yeshiva University, can directly attest to this. Not only does Rav Soloveitchik also keep at bay those debilitating forces of modernity that threaten to overwhelm and drown the fledgling orthodoxy, he did other things as well. It's a very powerful idea. This idea of surrendering to the Almighty, that I do what Hashem says because Hashem says so, and I try to understand things. But listen, it doesn't make sense. If it's against the law, I can't do it. And it's a topic which the Rav helped ingrain in orthodoxy throughout America, and it was a major part of the struggle against conservative Judaism, something all of us should work on and to learn from. And this concept that I do mitzvot because Hashem said so. It's good to understand the reasons for mitzvot too, but bottom line, I do the mitzvah even if I don't understand the reason. There's a famous vort from Avaron Soloveitchik. So I heard this from Avaron with a slightly different mashal. I'll change the mashal a little bit. The word ta'am means reason, the word ta'am means flavor. What's the significance of the same word having those two meanings? So he said as follows. Well, he says like this. The reasons for the mitzvos, they're not the essence of the mitzvah. But they just add flavor to the mitzvah. We do mitzvos because they're good for us. Hashem said so. They're healthy religiously, spiritually. For example, vitamins. You take vitamins. You go to a doctor and he tells you to take a certain vitamin. Okay. Why do we take the vitamins? Because we trust the doctor. Most people don't understand why this particular vitamin helps in this thing. We do trust the doctor with the vitamins. All right. And vitamins don't necessarily taste good, but they're healthy. They're good for you. Mitzvos are like vitamins. Hashem gives you a mitzvah. Hashem, obviously, Havdil, Elf, Alfa, Abdullah, is Kal Vachomer, smarter than the doctors. Hashem gives you a mitzvah. It's good for you. Spiritually, it's good for you. Physically, emotionally. Mitzvahs are good for us. Mitzvahs are like vitamins. We do the mitzvah because Hashem said so. If you trust the doctor, then Kal Vachomer, you trust Hashem. But when you understand the reasons for mitzvahs, it adds flavor to the mitzvah. The mitzvah talks to you more. You get more into the mitzvah. It's good to know the reasons for mitzvahs, but that's not why we do the mitzvah. You don't take vitamins because they taste good. If Hashem says it, I do what Hashem says. I surrender. Hashem says, no matter what, I can think this, I can think that. I can be convinced. Again, if the doctor tells you, a specialist says, this vitamin is good for you, you do what the specialist says. When you know the reasons for mitzvos, then you get more excited about the mitzvah. Mitzvos are like vitamins, and we said before, mitzvos with reasons are like Flintstones vitamins. It talks to you more. I think it's a perfect mushroom. You get excited about it, and it talks to you more. When you understand the reason for the mitzvah, you enjoy it more. You get more into it. That's wonderful. But that's not the essence of the mitzvah. I do the mitzvah because Hashem said so. If Hashem says it, I do it, period. That's the idea of surrender. I do what Hashem says because Hashem says so. Something we all should work on. Number two. Number three, humility. Humility. The Rav was a very, very, very humble person. Look in source number 11 on the same page. Despite his great stature and acclaim, the Rav was completely without any pretension of any sort. He never had a personal secretary. He would open the doors himself. He answered the phone himself. He never let me take out the garbage when he was aware I was doing so. Never let me take his bed. Never saw me washing dishes in the apartment without coming to stand beside me and converse with me until the chore was done. As I reflect upon those occasions, I'm overwhelmed to realize the picture of humility they paint. And Rav Twersky, when he spoke about his grandfather, he said that my grandfather was so humble, and he did it so at ease, you didn't realize he was being humble. That's an added madriga. Someone is such a giant, and it was so at ease. It wasn't like, oh my gosh, the God of my door is getting up and clearing the table and doing the dishes. He did it so matter-of-factly, just that's what he did. And this is an additional element of what it means to be humble, totally without pretense, something that we all can learn from. Source number 12 is a story that's described there. I heard this story on a tape. Again, after the Rebbe's Nifter, his daughter spoke, Rebbe Timchorsky, spoke in Boston. She told the following story. There was a great Rav named Rav Chaim Heller, Zatzal. He was an older mentor of the Rav, almost like a father figure for the Rav. The Rav knew him for many years. And the Rav treated him with tremendous, tremendous respect. There are stories that the Rav would give a yahrzeit share in front of thousands of people. And if Rav Chaim came in late, the Rav would go over and like help him with his coat and find a seat for him. And then go back and start giving the shiur. Rav Chaim Heller was a genius. And he thought quickly. And he was such an overwhelming genius because he was always saying so much and so much. Okay. So one summer, the Rav was giving a summer class in YU. And Rav Heller was giving a class as well. And the Rav had a large enrollment. Rav Heller's class wasn't a large enrollment because it was such a genius. Somehow people, it was hard. So the Rav asked the registrar to schedule his class right before Rav Heller's class. So the Rav had a large enrollment. And then I heard this from the Rav's daughter on a tape. And then when his class ended, he said, okay, now we're going to go to Rav Heller's class. So if the Rav says, go to Rav Heller's class, so you go to Rav Heller's class. And you have this huge crowd going into Rav Heller's class. And Rav Chaim starts giving shir and Tanakh, and he quotes a pasuk of this in the Medrash. And the Rav says, just a minute. And then he would say, let us find that pasuk. And he'd find the pasuk. He stood there next to Rav Chaim Heller and became a teaching assistant for the summer to give more kavod to that Rav Chaim should have a larger shir that people understand. The Gadol HaDor, a teaching assistant for the standing on his feet, finding the page and slowing him down and explaining, the Medrash that he's quoting and so to understand it better. This is what it means to be a humble person. Now, just one idea, a very important idea about humility and gaiva. Anyways, it's appropriate for Pesach now. We know that the Zohar says, I don't want the Zohar, but the Sfarim quote, the Zohar says, that chametz is like the Yetzirah and matzah is the Yetzirah Tov. So one of the pshatim is that chametz is gaiva and matzah is more pashut. Chametz, it gets big, it's tall, it's big. So that's gaiva, it's big. I mean, basically bread, if you think about it, bread is literally full of itself. That's gaiva, I'm sorry. That's bread. And matzah is pashut, matzah is humble. Okay, so that's appropriate for Pesach to think about gaiva versus humility. It's important not to have gaiva, but you have to know. A person has healthy self-esteem, healthy self-awareness. How do you draw the line between the two? So I have a friend, his name is Rav Hillel Waxman, Shlita, big Talmud Chacham, and he once gave a beautiful, again, many Sfarim talk about this, but I like the way he said it was very sharp. I think it's a beautiful description you can almost use your whole lives, about gaiva versus appropriate humility and appropriate healthy self-awareness. And he said as follows. If you have an ability, you have an ability, you're good at something, you learn very well, you're talented, you're a good artist, you have an ability. To know you have an ability isn't gaiva. You know you have the ability. The issue of gaiva versus healthy self-awareness is, what's your next thought after you think about the ability that you have? If your next thought is, because I have this ability, I want others to treat me differently, that's gaiva. I'm smart. Hey, I should be head of the class, and I'm everyone should look up to me and always, you know, give me the extra cover because I'm smart. That's gaiva. If your next thought is, I'm smart, I can learn well, how can I use this? How can I apply the abilities that I have? That's not gaiva. That's very healthy self-awareness, healthy self-esteem. It's a perfect, in my opinion, a very, very good, sharp delineation. The Rav was the God of Hador. The Rav would just teach and teach and teach and teach. That's what you use it. That's, and it's an important idea. We have to remember to be humble and not to be bali gaiva. This is a very good definition. Uses your whole lives of gaiva. If you're good at something, good, you're good at something. Baruch Hashem. Thank Hashem you're good at something. What happens next? Because I'm good at this, oh, I deserve the kavod, that's gaiva. Because I'm good at this, I better use it well and apply it and get out there and help. Let me help others. Let me go teach. I'm good with people, so go into Kiyuv and help, go into Kiyuv, go into social work, go and use it. I'm an artist, so good. Write books with pictures on the Parsha. Books beyond the Parsha, go to use it in a positive way, help spread Torah. That's wonderful. That's not gaiva, that's healthy self-awareness. Okay. Number four is, I called it here, never responding. There's probably a better term than that, but that's the term that I use. This is going to be sources 13, which is on page 3, and then sources 13 B and C, which is going to be on page 7. So page 3 and page 7. Okay. The reality was, for whatever the reason, you know, that sometimes the Rav had certain positions where he was in the minority amongst the Gedolim, and sometimes his positions were attacked. If he was attacked, that happened. Okay. And this only struck me this year when I read this. And again, the source 13, it struck me only this year. The Rav never responded. He never felt the need to yell back. He never felt the need to defend himself. He just went out with his business of teaching Torah, learning Torah, and spreading Torah. And it's Mamash Maimer Chazal that all of us really should learn from. And when you think about it, the Rav was Mamash, and it seems, look at the reality of those 50 years. Mamash, the Gadol Hador in this area. There's a Gemara in Yuma, source 13, it's the second paragraph. The Gemara is talking about Oyev Hashem. The Gemara says, we are told, Hanelevim Beinam Olvim, those who were insulted and do not insult in return, Shomim Kharpasim Bainim Mashivim, who have hurt, who hear themselves humiliated and don't retort. Osim Me'avo, who smeichim be a servant, who serve out of love and happen in spite of affliction. Then about them the Pasuk says, they're the true Ohav Hashem. The Gemara says this is a midah Jews should strive for. That they hear the insults and they don't return. They return them. They hear the humiliation, they don't have to yell back. It's a midah all Jews should strive for. The Gemara says, you consider an Ohav Hashem. This was the Rav. He never yelled back. He never felt the need. And there are stories that they tell here, and many, many stories that you should read the 13a. He never allowed himself to be changed by whatever unpleasantness or insult was directed at him. The Rav would never have tolerated any of his talmidim referring to other Rosh Yeshiva by their initials, something that happened to Rav Soloveitchik from other people, in a Derech Zilzal. I've spoken about this many times. He never expressed bitterness about the fact that this was happening to him. It's an amazing sentence. That sentence this year really struck me. I spoke to him about this many times, and he never expressed bitterness about the fact that this was happening to him. How many of us get insulted by someone, we're angry, we yell back, who are you to yell at me? And we waste so much emotional energy getting angry at someone for doing something which was a mistake. You can go on with life. Go on with what you're doing. Develop this quiet confidence. I'm serving Hashem well. I'm doing what I'm supposed to be doing. This person said something not nice to me. They shouldn't have said it. All right, what do I gain by yelling back? We can learn from the Rav this idea. And there's an amazing story here. It's a little bit humorous. In 13b and 13c, and again, I'm on page 7 of the source sheets. Verse 13b. The Rav's generosity extended to those who criticized him and those who were jealous of him. He even raised money for their causes and institutions. This is well known, that the Rav encouraged his big supporters, his big donors, he encouraged them to also give money and support to the other institutions which were not part of the Rav's immediate orbit. It's well known. And again, after the Rav was nifter, Rav Willig discussed this. Rav Willig Shlita. Anyway, but Rav Willig Shlita, when the Rav was nifter, he spoke about this. That if you look at this, is interesting, and not everyone's aware of this. If you go to some of the big yeshivas in the yeshiva shevelt, some of the big names of the donors who helped build the yeshivas in the beginning are the same names that were the major donors who supported causes the Rav was involved in. And the Rav sent them there. And it's something, it's one of those hidden, not everyone, hidden secrets that the Rav's role in building the Torah world in America, the broader Torah world as well, not just his own orbit, narrow orbit of the YU world and Boston, but the broader world as well, the financial support, he was a major pusher to encourage his supporters to give there as well. And the Rav will emphasize this when he spoke about the Rav after the Rav was nifted. Then here there's an amazing story, a fabulous story, source 13c. While visiting the Rav once, I remember seeing a mashulach from the Eda Acharedis at his door, who flashed a check at me, signed by the Rav, as if to say, Mr. C, the Rav gave me even more than you. This was quite true. This person didn't want to give this person such a large donation. He wasn't in his orbit. I went inside and confronted the Rav. Rebbe, do you know who that was? I asked. Yes, I'm fully aware, he replied. Rebbe, do you realize that were you to set foot in Israel, at Israel's soil, he would lead a bunch of his followers with posters and yelling on the tarmac of Ben Gurion Airport, go home, Rabbi Soloveitchik. He's one of your greatest attractions. You gave him money, you gave him support. He looked at me and smiled and said, yes, he replied. But he promised not to use the money I gave him for the posters. Now, it's a classic story. And this exactly fits with who the Rav was. He went on with his life of learning Torah, teaching Torah, never yelled back. And these are many, many stories like this, many, many stories where he himself and he would push others to give this financial support as well. Something we all can learn from. How many times, again, we get caught up in petty things, and here the God of Ador is being attacked, and he didn't yell back. We have to yell back if somebody does something wrong to us. You can get past that and you can move on. Like I said, you want to develop a quiet confidence in your Avodah Hashem. I'm serving Hashem, I'm doing the right thing, and I'm not a bald guy, I don't need all the recognition. I get the recognition upstairs in a more important place. And I don't have to respond if people do these things. Okay, that's number four. I call here pleasure from learning and doing mitzvot. This is going to be sources 15 and 16. Oh, it's the same page. Okay, just some fabulous quotes here. Again, this is the Rav speaking. He was talking about what he learned from his Malamed. In Malamed, when he was younger, what he learned from his Malamed, he said, my Malamed taught me how to experience Yadis, to live it. And look here in the third paragraph. This he got from his Malamed. Studying the Torah Shebaal Peh, the oral tradition, and complying with its precepts are the greatest pleasure a person can have. Studying the Torah Shebaal Peh, the oral tradition, and complying with its precepts are the greatest pleasure a person can have. It is an exciting, romantic adventure. It is the most cleansing and purging experience a human being can experience. The Avzakin teaches the Yelo Zakunim how to live and how to feel Yadus. Tremendous power in that sentence is unbelievable. Source 16, this is from Rav Reichman Shlita in YU, that when the Rav would learn the Mochamos, a papyrus in the back of the Gemara, it's very difficult. And it was like conquering like Mount Everest. My Rebbe Rav Shechter Shlita would always like climbing Mount Everest. And he writes here, look at the last few lines of 16. In the Ramban, the Rav always searched for the chiddush that was usually found in one line that followed 2 dozen lines of complex discourse. When he discovered this, it would be with the utmost pleasure and illustrated by the widest smile one has ever seen. The simcha the Rav had when he figured it out and cracked the nut, that's the other picture. If you look at the biography, the second volume, the picture on the cover is the wide smile. And again, I wasn't in the Rav Shir, but the Rav told me to say, when he felt he figured it out, the simcha he had, the joy of learning, of figuring out that he's involved in this Avodas Hashem, and he cracked it out of the learning, this beautiful wide smile flashed across his face. The lesson for us is obvious. We have to appreciate what we have here. It's great to be an Orthodox Jew. It's a life of fulfillment, a life of meaning. It's the greatest pleasure a person can have. How many of us, how hard we should daven to try to reach this level? That we should feel this is the greatest pleasure a person, and it is the greatest pleasure a person can have. It gives your life meaning. the greatest pleasure, because it's a pleasure which hits the neshama. And when your neshama feels the pleasure, that's the ultimate pleasure. What's the sipuk nefesh that we have in our avodas Hashem? We have to appreciate what it means that we have the schus to learn Torah, to keep the Torah, to do the mitzvos. Without the Torah mitzvos, life is empty. And with Torah mitzvos, it's the greatest pleasure a person can have. One little idea about this, it's really mussar for fathers, but it's mussar for life in general. Heard this from Rav Orlowick Shlita. He talks about, and I'm mentioning it because it connects with this idea of simcha, and I'll get to it in a few minutes. He talks about that sometimes fathers can be the worst carbuses for their children, for their sons. Because fathers feel this pressure that I want my son to be the biggest Talmud Chacham and know more than I do, and there's a pressure. And then when you're learning, there's a pressure, and it's tense. So then a child begins to associate learning Torah with his father with negative thoughts. Oh, and that's terrible. That a son should think that it's negative and it's pressured and tense. Therefore, Rav Orlowick says, you have to be careful. And if you're going to go with your son, you have to lower the pressure. And he gives good advice. He says, when you're learning with your son, always offer, is a great piece of advice, always suggest to end the learning session 5 minutes before the scheduled time. Meaning if the learning is going well, end now. Because to end on a positive note is more important than that next Mishnah, that next five lines of Gemara, the next 5 minutes. Because if in the next 5 minutes you want to squeeze in the Mishnah and you push a little more and then it gets antsy, if the learning goes well, now sometimes if you have 8 minutes to learn with your son, and you stop 5 minutes early, it doesn't leave you much time. Okay, you got to do the best you can. Baruch Hashem, yeah, you got to do the best you can. But the concept to end, to make the learning be positive and happy, that a child should feel that his father thinks that learning Torah, learning with him is the greatest simcha, is something all of us should strive for. Shlomo Zalman Zatzal, his son, talks about that he learned with his father. All he felt was his father, the tremendous simcha his father had. I'm zochah to see this. I worked in the Old City, and yeshiva in the Old City, and Rav Nevin saw Shlita, so he learns in the Beis Medrash in our yeshiva. He learns every morning and every night. And at night, a few nights a week, he learns with one of his grandsons. And it's amazing. He sits there and he smiles for 40 minutes straight. You have to see this. He sits there and he's with his grandson learning and he's smiling at his grandson while they're learning for 40 minutes straight. And it's tremendous to see. So if we can take that lesson from this idea, it starts from us. If we feel pleasure in learning and doing mitzvos, then there's a chance of passing it on and having our children feel that connection. Oh, my parents like doing mitzvahs, they do mitzvahs with me, it's simchadik, it's fulfilling. It starts from us, and this is a challenge all of us should take in our own lives from what the Rav says to get to this level where we feel that learning and doing mitzvahs is the greatest pleasure a person can feel. That's number five. That's number six. Number seven, I call having a sensitive soul. This is numbers 23. And Chesed, 23, 24, and 25. This is again on. This is on the very left. On the 23 is on page. What I have page 6, and 24 and 25 is on page. What I have page 7. A Jew is supposed to be a giving person. A Jew is supposed to have a sensitive soul. And this was the Rav. Source 23 again from one of the Rav's Shamashim. In the middle of the paragraph in source 23. Hearing the pain of another Jew had an effect on the Rav. His meetings with people, whether it was with Menachem Begin or with a simple Jew, never became routine. After meeting with someone in distress, it would become harder for the Rav to walk, sleep, and eat. Recognizing how the Rav internalized the pain of the others, we made sure not to schedule consecutive appointments to ensure that he would not be emotionally taxed. Wow. After meeting with someone in distress, it would become harder for the Rav to walk, sleep, and eat. Next paragraph. Toward the end of his tenure at YU, one of us would sleep in the Rav's apartment. The Rav would always wake up early. But I remember once waking up around 3 o'clock in the morning and realizing that the Rav was not in his bed. He was sitting in his chair in the living room. I asked him what was wrong. Apparently that afternoon, some individual just asked him a halacha question. He told him to return the next day for the answer. The Rav said that he knew what the halacha was, but it would be heartbreaking for them. Therefore, he could not sleep. Okay? The lesson is obvious. Jews are supposed to have a sensitive soul. Someone has tzaras, someone unburdens themselves to you, it should have an impact. And if it doesn't, then there's something missing there. We have to be no sebolim chaveiro. And someone's having tzaras, even if you can't help the person. But you have to have a sensitive soul, something we can all learn from the Rav. Source 25 on page 7 is another well-known story. I heard the story also from, was on the same tape from the Rav's daughter, Rebetzin Tversky. Told as follows: when the Rav gave shir, there was no clock. Shir was officially an hour and a half, 2 hours long, but it sometimes went for 3 hours longer. So he was finished. If it was stuffy, it would go much longer. We saw it, a 7 hour shir. That already was a little bit more than normal. So there was a time once where for 6 weeks, shir ended on the dot, hour and 20 minutes. Very strange. So what happened? So what happened was as follows. It was the boy in the rough shir, the Lalein, who had cancer, and he needed chemotherapy treatments. So he went up to the Rav to ask him if he was going to have to leave the shir early for 6 weeks, twice 6 weeks for the treatments. So he told the Rav that he would have to leave early for those 6 weeks to ask permission and to ask mechila. So for the next 6 weeks, what the Rav did was he had a clock on the table, his watch, and he stopped shir exactly at the time that the boy wouldn't have to leave early, embarrassing and hard for him, wouldn't have to leave early and be able to get to the chemotherapy on time. When the session ended, the Rav went back to normal. This is how you have to live your life, to be sensitive to the difficulties of others and do your best to help. Along these lines, the Rav was tremendously free with the giving of his time. And many stories about this that come. One is in Source 24, they're on the same page. He writes here as follows: the Rav displayed profound compassion and empathy for the oppressed and was intolerant only of injustice or falsehood. He could be depended upon to give freely of his time and energy to respond to anyone in need. He was a true anav, etc. Look at the next column in 24. This Rav went to visit the Rav, and he was waiting to talk to the Rav. This is Rav Hachfer Goshlita. As the call subsided, the Rav turned his attention to my questions, penetrating quickly to the core of each issue, finishing answers to each query, and cogently elucidating the halachic reasoning behind such each response. This took about a few minutes, and then, for nearly an hour, the Rav proceeded to ask about my family, about my late father-in-law, including the treatments which were then being pursued for his illness and possible alternatives, about the shul and the day school, and about many people in the community whom he knew personally, etc. As I rose to leave and to thank the Rav for his time and his help, he profusely thanked me for coming and asked me to stay in touch. I had not wanted to bother him. He made me feel that I had done him a tremendous favor. From the Rav's perspective as a true gadol, perhaps I had. You're a gadol, your time is precious. And the Rav taught by example to be giving of his time to help others. And if you know some of the Rav's Talmidim, my Rebbeim, the Rav's Talmidim, it's unbelievable that the way they give freely of their time. Their time is precious, and people ask them questions, and they're always with a smile, with an answer, and give of one's time. And you can see in the Rav's close Talmidim where they learned this lesson from the Rebbe, something all of us should strive to emulate. If you're in a position where you can help others, you have to do your best to give whatever time you can. And it's something we all should learn and be inspired from Rav Soloveitchik. Okay. Next, we have two more here, and these are really the most potent ones. Later we're going to be having, I should have mentioned this earlier, we'll be playing a few minutes when the Rav himself is speaking. We'll get down a few minutes. Bez Hashem. And okay, a tape here from the Rav. The next one I call Feeling the Shechina. I guess this is number 8. Feeling the Shechina. These are numbers 17, 18, and 19. Where is it? In mine it's on page 5. And it's page 4. Okay. Just the Rebbe talk about himself and in a very personal way, and just unbelievable. Here's the Rebbe's talking. Sort number 17. People do not know how busy I am and what my schedule is. They know I teach shurim here in New York. All right, fine. I teach shurim three times a week in the yeshiva. You know, these shurim should be an hour and a half each. It never happens that I'm through with the shiur in an hour and a half. It's 2 hours, sometimes 3 hours. It is very strange. The boys in my class are very young, perhaps a quarter, a third of my age, yet they come out rejuvenated, and I come out refreshed after the shiur. That's very important. We'll get back to that again in Be'ez Hashem in a few minutes. It's a very powerful idea. When you're in the Masorah, and you're an old man, but you're with the Masorah, when you teach Torah, you come to life. And I saw this myself. We'll get to it a little bit later. And this happens all the time. People will see this with the Rebbe all the time. An old man, he had back pain, different troubles. He gave shiur. Shiur ended. And he was as shiur went on, he came to life. That we'll get back to. Then I returned to Boston every Friday morning from 8:30 for 3 hours until 11:30. I sat with my son-in-law, Rabbi Yitzchak Schwirsky. Saturday, Shabbos, believing that I cannot afford to take a nap on Shabbos afternoon. I have not taken a nap on Shabbos afternoon for the last, I would say, 20 years. Because I studied with Moshe Tversky, his grandson, 3 hours at least. And I studied with Meir Tversky, well, for us, about Meir Tversky, 2.5 hours. The same with Sunday and the same with Monday. And so we have no time sometimes to sit and relax. We have to, again, this gets back to what we said before, that Tversky Shlita spoke about. The Rav spent most of his life over an open Gemara. That's what he spent his time doing primarily. Somehow, the next paragraph, the third line, when I open up the Gemara, either alone or when I am in company, as when I teach others, I have the impression, do not call it hallucination, as if I hear, so to say, the soft footsteps of somebody invisible. He comes in and sits down with me, sometimes up over my shoulder. It's a simple idea, not mystical at all. Our Sheikh has already stated that the presence of Hashem dwells amongst those who occupy themselves with Torah. Very powerful idea. The Rav would speak about over and over again that he would feel the Shechina when he was learning. The experiential part of learning. It's a tremendous idea. Something everyone should daven for, to try to achieve something like this. It's a high level. That the Rav would be learning, and you're learning Torah, which is the thoughts of Hashem in the Torah, and Kav Yochel, and you connect with the Shechina. And this leads, and again, number 19, a similar number 19. Again, the Rav speaking. There are times when I learn Torah very late at night. As is well known, the nights are especially beneficial for the study of Torah. There are times at night when I feel as if somehow, someone, the Divine Presence, is standing behind me, bending himself to go over my shoulder to peer into the Talmudic text at the topic I am studying at that moment. At times he nods his head in agreement with the explanation I am attempting to develop, etc. It's uncommon for a gadol to open up his soul like this and to let us in to what it means to be learning Torah and feeling the Shechina be right there. This leads to the other idea, number 18, that this concept of feeling the Shechina, if learning Torah becomes feeling the Shechina, then you never want to leave. And the Rebbe would often speak about this idea. The Gemara talks about that there's no comparison if someone who chazers something 101 times, if you chazer it 100 times. Now, if you review something 100 times, you know it already. So what's so big about, what's so important about the, what's not important, what's so significant, what's so special about the extra 101st time? Big deal, one more time. So the Rav said, that's the whole point, you do know it already. The 101st time reflects, I don't want to leave. I'm stuck here with Hashem, with the Torah, I don't want to leave. If you're talking to Hashem, you don't want to leave. A person is having a great Shemona Esrei, you don't want to end it. Let's read inside, Source 18, the last few lines of the first paragraph. The Torah became like a magnet. Even if they knew the passages totally by heart, they still could not depart from the text. They could not leave the Gemara. It was as if they were tied to the Gemara. This is exactly the same sensation that was experienced by the student who refused to depart even after he repeated this chapter 100 times. Well, they felt that studying the Torah was a rendezvous with the Shechina, the Divine Presence. Therefore, they constantly sought to prolong the experience. They just couldn't bring themselves to close the text. This speaks for itself. What a madrega. Something we all should daven for, to get to the level where when you learn Torah, you're doing mitzvot, you feel that connection with the Kodesh Baruch Hu. By the way, this is not Hasidish. This is in the classic Sfarim. If you're interested, there's a tremendous Bach. Bach is a parish on the tour in Siman Mem Zion, where he talks about when a person's learning Torah, it's Dveikus Hashem. And that's before Hasidus. And this idea that when, this is the Gemara says, you learn Torah, if you're at the level and You feel the Shechinah there with you. The Rebbe talked about this many times. Something all of us should try to learn from and be inspired. Finally, number nine, and this is really the most important one, is the concept of Nesova. The Rebbe discussed this all the time. If there's one theme that there was a constant refrain in the Rebbe's writings and his lives and his speeches, the concept of the Nesova. Yeah, this is about Nesova. We all receive a tremendous tradition from our parents and our teachers. We have to guard it, absorb it, keep it, and pass it on to the next generation. He says this once. He says this once in number 9 on page 2. He quotes here again, the Rebbe speaking. Abraham is important because he's willing to pass on his traditions to his children and grandchildren. Whatever Abraham had achieved, he wishes to transmit to his children. And he quotes the pasuk that when the Torah is decided why Hashem chose Abraham, it's because Yedativ, I know that he will command his children and grandchildren to follow in his path. Mesorah was the essence of why Hashem chose Abraham to be the first Jew. That's what the Torah says. He quotes the pasuk. I've known him because he commands his children and his household after him that they must keep the way of the Lord. The individual is responsible not only for himself but for the future. Perhaps his main responsibility is to the future and the countless generations that will come after him. That's Judaism. The individual is responsible not only for himself but for the future. Perhaps his main responsibility is for the future. The motto of the Jew has always been the importance of the Mesorah, tradition, pass on and transmit. You receive from your father and must transmit these traditions to your children. We talk about this all the time, the concept of the Mesorah, and this is why, and this also gets back to the idea of surrender. The Rebbe was very reluctant to make changes in things. In many, many areas, he was a tremendous stickler for the old Minhagim. This is part of our Mesorah. And when our Rebbe Rav Shechter Shlita spoke about the Rebbe a lot after the Rebbe was nifted, it's also in his book, Nefesh HaRav, he would talk about this idea of the Mesorah. That the Rebbe felt he had this tremendous Mesorah from Europe, from the Rabbanim and his parents, his father and grandfather and the Gedolim in Europe, and he wanted to pass it along. And it took 40 years, a little here, a little there, to pass it along. But it goes much deeper than that. Because we're going to be doing now numbers 20, 21, and 22, and 22a. When the Rav spoke about the Mesorah, he said something which is just, you have to read it. Mamash, from the time he was a young child till he was an old man, the Rav felt that the Mesorah was mamash a lot. It's a lot. That when you're in the Mesorah, Rashi is alive next to you. The Rambam is alive. He's sitting there in the room with you. It's the most powerful idea. And the Rav described this, and it's, you have to hear it, how the Rav spoke about himself. We'll read 20 when the Rav was a child, 21 when he was a teenager, it seems like, and then 22 when he was an old man, then we'll play the tape. Number 20. Let me stress the idea of the Mesorah by telling you a personal story. I remember that when I was growing up, I was a lonely boy, but I had one friend. I'm skipping parts. Do not laugh at me, it was the Rambam. How did he become friends? Simply, we met. The Rambam was a constant guest in our home. During the days when my father was a newlywed, supported by my grandfather, my father studied Torah day and night. A small group of attending young scholars gathered around him and eagerly absorbed his teaching. My father studied with his disciples in the room where my bed was located. My want was to sit up in my bed and listen to my father's words. He constantly quoted Maimonides. This is one way to have a son who's a gadol. You give shir next to him in bed. Okay, that's what he did. Rav Shechter once said that the Rav once mentioned in shir that when you don't want to go to sleep, but you know, when you try to read under the covers, you know, you want to stay awake, and, you know, with a flashlight or something. So the Rav said he did that. And Rav Shechter said that the Rav said that he finished the Minchas Chinuch by the time of his bar mitzvah. And as Rav Shechter says, that's quite a feat. You have to know Shas to learn the Minchas Chinuch. The Minchas Chinuch is one of the most difficult svarim, and he goes ins and outs. And he said, Rav Shechter said in one in tape I heard, that the Rav said he finished the Minchas Chinuch for the time of his bar mitzvah. Wow. Let's go on. Next paragraph. My father would inevitably discover that Maimonides rejected the basic explanation of the text and is different with those folks. My father would declare, as if to complain, that we cannot comprehend the approach and inclusion of the Rambam towards the Talmudic text. I'm skipping a few lines. The students would jump forward and each would express his thoughts. My father would carefully listen, would refute their proposed interpretations. Finally, my father would gradually lift his head and begin to expound the true meaning of the Rambam. Sometimes he'd be lengthy, in other cases he'd be brief. I would strain my ears. In my young and impressionable mind, there developed a dual impression. First, that the Rama was being attacked by the enemies, that the Masorah was alive, who wanted to hurt him. And second, that the Rambam only defender was my father. I felt strongly that without my father, who knows what would happen to the Rambam. It was as if the Rambam himself was with us in the room. We're with us and listening to my father's words. The Rambam sat next to me on my bed. What did he look like? I don't know exactly. He seemed to look like an exceedingly handsome and good father. His name was also Moshe, just like my father. This is what the Rambam was like as a kid. He felt his best friend was the Rambam. This is the room. Okay. That's when he was a child. Then, source 21. Sorry. 28. Sorry, we're not finished. 28. So 28, the fifth line, sixth line. My mind has emerged triumphant, and my father's face was filled with happiness and delight. Again, the simcha and the learning. He had defended his friend, Rabbeinu Moshe, the Rambam. The Rambam was comforted and smiled. I too was delighted and joined in the feeling of joy in the room. I would jump from my bed and run to my mother and cry out the good news. Mother, mother, the Rambam won. He beat the Ravid. Father helped him. Look how wonderful my father is. But once in a great while, my father did not succeed. And despite all the efforts, the enemies of the Rambam defeated him. Their questions were strong as iron. Although my father mustered all his strength, he could not save the Rambam from his distractors. My father would raise his head and sadly state, there is no answer. The words of the Rambam are difficult. No one is capable of resolving the questions. The shiur ended with no explanation. The students were sad. Even my father was depressed. A sense of despair descended upon all of us. I cried. Even the eyes of the Rambam glistened with teardrops. With a broken heart, I would walk slowly to my mother and cry out to her, Mother, Father can't announce the Rambam. What will we do? He did not succeed today. My mother would tell me, don't worry. Father will find an answer for the Rambam. And if he does not succeed, when you grow up, perhaps you will find an answer to the Rambam. Always remember, my son, the important thing about Torah is to study it in happiness and enthusiasm. That charge stayed with the Rav his whole life, as we saw before. It is true the story is part of my youth. It is not, however, the fantasy of a young child or the creation of mystical feelings. The story is a historic and psychological reality that guides me at all times. When I sit down to learn, the giants of the Masorah are with me. Our relationship is personal. This is so powerful. The Masorah is alive. This Rav would always describe when you're sitting learning a Rashi. Rashi's right there. Rashi's dead physically, but his ideas live on. We're part of the Masorah. We're part of this tremendous Masorah back to Har Sinai. We have to appreciate this. We're part of a living reality. It's like pulsing. Learning Torah is the intense experience of uniting many generations together. The joining of spirit, the end of the paragraph, the page. The joining of spirit to spirit, the connecting of soul to soul. Those who transmit the Torah and those who receive the Torah are invited to meet one another at the same historic junction. That's the Rav as a young child. 21, the Rav talks about being at a Seder. Get the impression he's a little older here, he's a teenager. My father implanted within me the understanding that the essence of my existence is my Rebbe. If I cut myself off from my past, I impair my own being. My feeling, and the next paragraph, that the Rambam was present at our Seders. My father would constantly refer to the Rambam and his use of the Kiddush and the Maror and the Haggadah. To me, the Rambam became a true-to-life companion. Still the same, it's Mamash. The Rav's getting older now, the same thing. This is the basic concept of the Jewish covenant with roots in its, which roots us in the past. I have planted an orchard, an Eshel, in Be'er Sheva. Why a tree? The trees in the orchard symbolize the Jewish people who are rooted in the past just as the tree is rooted in the ground. This relationship results in the Jews proclaiming the name of Hashem of the universe. The Jews retain their spirituality because they have roots which cannot be severed. We have to understand that our lives are based on what we have from the past that we're guarding and keeping and then passing on to the next generation. This is the Rav, the Masorah is alive. And finally, this might be the most famous speech that's printed from the Rav. The Rav once spoke at Pidyon HaBen, and he described, he was 71 years old, he described what it was like giving shiur as an old man. And exactly the same idea of the Masorah coming to life. And I'm going to read it now. And then, see, the quality of the tape is not so good. So I'm going to read it myself to you first. And if you hear me read it once, then we hear the tape again, and you follow along. I think it's came out word for word. You hear the Rav speak and describe himself giving shiur, what it means as an old man, as we'll describe. The Rav was at a Pidyon HaBen, and we'll discuss in a few, as we said a little bit later, the idea of the Masorah was on his mind. And you see a baby in front of you, and we'll get to later the details. And the Masorah, and the Rebbe was discussing what it means to teach Torah as a grandfather. Yaakov Avinu taught Torah to his grandchildren, the Torah describes, the Medrash describes. Oh, and the Rebbe was also discussing, there's a term in the Mishnah, it's called Misvar Adoros. It's a difficult term to explain, the number of the generations. What exactly does that mean? So the Rebbe explained, Misvar Adoros means that a father teaches a son the Mesorah. The generations that come before us, that the number of the generations, this is what a father teaches a son, the contour of the Mesorah. I'm reading now from source 22. There's rather a sharing of the ideas and ideals which span and unite countless generations. This is the secret language of Misvar Adoros, of uniting generations. Each newborn child enters an extended historical family where he will be reared by the wisdom and teachings of great Torah personalities. Whatever I've said now is not just an abstract idea, but an ongoing experience for me. Let me say that I constantly experience the secret of Misvar Adoros, of combining, uniting, and merging many generations into one community. This idea becomes real every time I enter the classroom at the yeshiva. In the yeshiva, years play no role. Centuries have no significance, and different generations can successfully communicate with each other. On the tape, there's a few more sentences here. My classroom is crowded with boys who, as far as age is concerned, could be my grandchildren. I enter the classroom as an old man. I am old, with a wrinkled face and eyes reflecting the fatigue and sadness of old age. You have to be old to experience this sadness. It is the melancholy that results from an awareness of people and things which have disappeared and linger only in memory. I sit down. Opposite me are rows of young, beaming faces with clear eyes, radiant in the joy of being young. When I enter the classroom, I'm filled with despair and pessimism. I always ask myself, can there be a dialogue between an old teacher and a young students, between a Rebbe and his Indian summer, and boys enjoying the spring of their lives? I start to shear, without knowing what the conclusion will be. Whenever I start to shear, the door opens and another old man walks in and sits down. My students call me the Rav. He is older than the Rav. He is the grandfather of the Rav. His name is Reb Chaim Brisker. Without his method of study, without whom, no shear could be delivered nowadays. Then the door opens quietly again, and another old man comes in. He is older than Reb Chaim, because he lived in the 17th century. His name is Avshabsai Cohen, the famous Shah. He must be present when Sibyl and Dina Mamanas are discussed, when we study the Metzia Bava Kama. Then more visitors show up, some from the 11th, 12th, and 13th centuries, some even in antiquity. Among them, Rabbi Akiva, Rashi, Rabbi Natar, the Ravid, the Rashba. More and more keep on coming in. So we're trying to turn to page 6. What do? I introduce them to my pupils. And the dialogue commences. The Rambam states a halacha, and the Ravid disagrees sharply. At times, the Ravid uses harsh language against the Rambam. A boy comes up to defend the Rambam against the Ravid. In his defense, the student expresses himself rashly, too outspoken in his critique of the Ravid. Young boys are wont to speak in such a fashion. So I correct him and suggest more restrained tones. Another boy jumps up with a new idea. The Rashba smiles gently. Apparently the Gedolim often smile around the Rav when he's giving shir. The Rashba smiles gently. I try to analyze what the young boy meant. Another boy intervenes. Rabbi Natan is called upon to express his opinion. And suddenly a symposium of generations come into existence. Young students debate early generations with an air of daring familiarity. And a crescendo of discussion ensues. We all speak one language. The whole world. We enjoy each other's company, speak one language, pursue one goal. All are committed to a common vision. All operate with the same halakha categories. A Mesorah collegiality is achieved. It is a friendship, a comradeship of young and old, spanning antiquity, the Middle Ages, and modern times. And that's the pshat of Misvar Adoros leads to B'hu HaKeitz, the unity of generations, the march of centuries. This dialogue and conversation between antiquity and the present will finally bring about the redemption of the Jewish people, B'hu HaKeitz. The messianic realization will come about because of this great dialogue of the generations. So that's the rough. There's a little more, but so we'll play the tape now. Well, the tape's going to be what I just read the last 5 minutes. And you can follow through it again. This is the rough talking as an old man. And then we'll give the background of where he gave this talk. So then we'll have a few more stories, and then we'll close. So we'll start now with the rough speaking. Thank you. Finish. Let me tell you, at the conclusion of the shir, which can sometimes last 3 or 4 hours, I emerge young. Younger than my pupils. They are tired and exhausted. I feel happy. I have defeated age. I feel young and rejuvenated in the Masorah experience. Years play no role. Hands. However, parched and dry and wrinkled, embrace warm and supple hands in a commonality, bridging the gap which separates the generations. This is how the Rav went through life. The Masorah is alive. What a chus that we have. And he gave this shir. Just to give the context, it was at a Pidyon HaBen, and the baby's father was in the Rav Shir at the time. He was the Rav Shamish. And the baby's grandfather had been in the Rav Shir 30 years earlier in the 1940s. And the Rav said during the speech that in the 1940s, when the grandfather entered Shir as a young man, the grandfather's grandfather sent the Rav a letter, keep an eye on my grandson for me, you know, and tell me about his progress. So the Rav had a 5-generational connection with this baby, and he was in a nostalgic mood and discussed the Masorah. This is the Masorah. It goes beyond the father, the grandfather. Once you're in the Masorah, it goes beyond the biology. And the Masorah is alive forever. And the Rav, you see, mamash, from a young child to an old man, the Masorah is alive, the people are alive. The Rav said, the Masorah is the essence of Yadus. Why are we given Yaakov's name? Why are we called B'nai Yisrael and Beis Yaakov? Because Yaakov was the only of the Avos that the Medrash describes had a very long, powerful connection with his grandchildren. He taught Torah for 17 years with Menashe and Ephraim. He became the Baal Masorah. Yaakov Avinu experienced the Masorah not only for one generation, but for two. So Yaakov symbolizes the Masorah even more than all the other Avos, because he went for one, also for two. He was the main Rebbe for Menashe and Ephraim. So therefore, we're given the name, the name of the Jewish people is the name of the Masorah, B'nai Yisrael and Beis Yaakov. It's very striking, different people have said this, that the parsha of Yaakov's death, what's the title of Yaakov's death? Vayichi Yaakov. And Yaakov lived. Beautiful idea. That even as Yaakov's dying, when you're in the Masorah, you're not dead. The Masorah lives on, your ideals live on. This was the Rav, this was the idea of the Masorah, and the lessons for us are obvious. And this idea that he emerges young from the Shir, it's an amazing thing. When you're in the Masorah, everyone's behind you, and you come to life. I experienced this myself when the Rav's brother, Aharon Salvechev Zatzal, gave Shir. I don't give Shir Parsha class. He's a very old man. He had a stroke. He would walk with a heavy walker. He'd come into a room, and he'd sit down and start giving the Shir, and 2 hours later, he could have gone on. We'd have said that we had to stop to daven. Evan Meyer, it was amazing to see when you're in the Masorah, you're teaching Torah, you come to life through the power of the Torah. These are ideas we should take from the Rav. What a fabulous Masorah that we have, and these are lessons and inspiration. I just want to end with two ideas that are based on Pesach, and also just a fabulous story. Again, I hope something to take with you. I only get this chance once a year. So, two ideas. At the Seder, we uncover the matzahs for most of Magid. And then, when you lift up the cup of wine, you cover the matzahs. That's what the Rama says. Why do you do that? Because it's embarrassing for the matzah that we're holding the wine in front of the matzah. Matzah is hamotzi, and wine is only hagefen. So matzah comes first. How come I'm holding the wine? I haven't made the bracha on the matzah. So it's embarrassing. Boshto, it's embarrassing to the matzah. So you cover the matzah, it shouldn't be embarrassed. That's the same reason why we cover the challahs on Shabbos, Friday night, Shabbos day, because it's embarrassing for the bread that we're holding the wine and making the bracha on the wine first. So last we checked, matzah and bread are inanimate. They don't have feelings and emotions. What's going on here? So the Pashuk Shad is, Rabbi Shech Hashita says this over all the time. The Pashuk Shad, of course, is not the matzah and the bread. It's people. We're supposed to take a mushel from the matzah and the bread, how we treat people. And if we're supposed to be concerned for the quote-unquote feelings of matzah and bread, how much more so we have to be concerned for the feelings of people and to treat people with dignity and with respect. And that's what a person should think about at the table, at the Shabbos table, at the Seder table, the story that's told. The story proves the point in the opposite direction. A Rav came to a certain town, and a certain Baal Bas had the schluss of having the Rav over at his house. And he comes home, and it turns out that when he walked in the house, his wife, you know, was a little behind schedule with different things, and the house wasn't ready for Shabbos, for the Friday night meal. So this guy was embarrassed that he walks into the house and the table wasn't set, the challahs weren't covered. So this guy was embarrassed that maybe this chash of a Rav will think that he doesn't know the halach, he has to cover the challahs for Kiddush. So the guy turns and yells at his wife, "Don't you know we have to cover the challahs for Kiddush?" And he starts yelling at his wife about covering the challahs. And the whole point of covering the challahs is to learn from that to treat people with respect. That story captures the point. It's a good idea that when you see the challah cover Friday night, and when you cover the matzahs at the Seder, we're supposed to think about, we have people here at the Seder, we have family members, and we have children, and we have guests, and you know, you don't want to let, you know, we want to fulfill the mitzvahs of the Seder, and the mitzvahs der rice, the mitzvahs der abana, and we don't want to let our zeal fulfilling the mitzvahs, sometimes you get angry, you get annoyed at people, you don't want that to happen. And looking at the challah cover, and looking at the covered matzahs, should remind us to treat everyone at the Seder with dignity, with respect. And that's the depth of what Rama is saying, that when you lift up the wine, you cover the matzahs at the Seder. Okay, we'll stop.